Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 176. It's Monday, August 15th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's start and get out of the way the local COVID-19 update. It looks like COVID-19 is still roiling about in our community. It seems in the last couple weeks that we've had a sort of a reversal of fortune where Ohio is now slightly worse than the nation as a whole, although there seems to be this long broil over the summer, and Lucas County's been in that for about 4 months. We did see a rise in a local number of reported cases in Lucas County, up to 112 a day on average from 105, but of course this is a massive undercounting, probably talking at least 10 times that amount in actual cases. We do see just a slight relief, maybe a downward trend in the testing positivity rates, although they still remain in the terrible range, 18% locally, 20% statewide, and about 17% in the nation as a whole. And we did see a slight increase in the number of active COVID-19 cases in nursing homes, one of the few places where we do regular surveillance. So we had 70 active cases versus 66 in the previous week. That was 38 residents and 32 staff. Fortunately, we haven't had any more deaths in long-term care facilities, although in the last 14 days, we've had about one Lucas County resident die every other day. As far as the reported deaths, of course, there's a lag in that, but it gives you a little idea what's going on locally. Hospitalizations and ICU patients in the U.S. seem to be a sort of a plateau here and maybe even on a downward trend. Hopefully, we'll be seeing that soon, but we've been at a plateau of about 43,000 people in the hospital on any given day this last week and about 5,000 in the ICU, although those numbers for hospitalizations and ICU patients is actually edging up in Ohio and Lucas County. It's not over yet. And deaths, the lagging indicator that seemed to caught up over this long broil over the summer, were at about 500 deaths per day in the U.S. That does not seem acceptable. But, of course, given the million-plus infections we're having every day, that's a lot less deaths per infection than we had earlier in the pandemic. But when you have so much infection going around, you're going to see deaths. Okay, and a few COVID-19 stories to get us up to date. This from Stat News. CDC eases COVID-19 quarantine and testing guidelines as it marks a new phase in the pandemic. People who are not up to date with their COVID-19 vaccines and who are exposed to someone infected with the coronavirus no longer need to quarantine, according to updated recommendations issued last Thursday by the CDC. Instead, they should just wear a mask for 10 days in indoor settings and test on day 5, according to the guidance. They were previously recommended to stay home. The new guidelines could also ease the testing burden on schools. While people showing symptoms of COVID should be tested, the recommendations say broader screening might not be cost-effective in general community settings, especially if COVID-19 prevalence is low. Of course, most of the country is not in that state at the moment. Such widespread testing could still be done in certain settings like long-term care facilities, correctional facilities, and homeless shelters. The agency is no longer recommending test-to-stay policies for schools when unvaccinated children exposed to someone with COVID could stay in school as long as they tested negative instead of having to quarantine. Sarah Lee, a school expert at the CDC, said the agency removed the test-to-stay guideline because the agency no longer recommended quarantine broadly. But she said on a press call that schools could still consider using widespread testing during outbreaks or during periods of high COVID-19 prevalence for events like sports tournaments and proms or for after-school breaks. Taken together, the new guidance no longer comes across as a list of things to do or to avoid, and instead offers more general guidelines about what settings present more of a threat to transmission, indoor crowded settings with poor ventilation, and who is at higher risk for more severe outcomes of a COVID infection, essentially older people and those with health issues, particularly if they are unvaccinated or not up to date with shots, which of course is like half the population. For example, the guidelines de-emphasize physical distancing as a specific strategy people should adhere to, instead framing it as just one step people can employ to decrease their risk of getting COVID. People can assess their need to take precautions like distancing and masking based on local transmission levels and how well ventilated the area they're in is, the guidelines say. One recommendation that remains the same: people with COVID should isolate for at least 5 days and perhaps longer, depending on how sick they get and whether their symptoms persist. If people leave isolation on day 5, they should wear a mask through day 10 or test negative over 48 hours before they stop wearing a mask. The guidelines come as the country has entered into perhaps a new phase of the virus, one with persistently high transmission and what would have once been a jarring number of daily deaths, but also one that many experts foresee as our consistent pattern for at least the near future. Separately, the Food and Drug Administration also issued a safety communication last Thursday advising that at-home rapid antigen tests can deliver false negative results. For those with COVID symptoms, the FDA now advises that people take 2 home COVID tests over 48 hours. For those who do not have symptoms but suspect a COVID exposure, the FDA now recommends up to 3 separate tests, each separated by a 48-hour period. The CDC's latest recommendations are just that. In most cases, actual policies would have to be set at state or local levels, and political leaders broadly rolled back mandatory mitigation efforts months ago. Already, most communities and individuals have moved on from embracing precautionary measures. The CDC still recommends that people living in areas with high level of transmission, roughly 40% of communities as of last Thursday, wear masks in public indoor settings, but it does not seem that many people are looking to the CDC maps to make a decision about whether to mask up or not. Okay, well, next up, I'd like to offer just a little bit of a critique from an epidemiologist. This is from my epidemiologist at yourlocalepidemiologist.substack.com. This is Caitlin Jetalina, an epidemiologist. The CDC released much-anticipated guidance for COVID-19. In all, the guidance is much more relaxed, as headlines are dealing. It's difficult to organize my million thoughts, but here are a few. One, the goal. I appreciate that CDC clearly defined their goal, reduce severe disease. Some may not agree with it, but we finally have clarity on what the CDC is actually trying to control and prevent. On one hand, this goal makes sense. Cases are clearly decoupling from hospitalizations, and we are in a different place than before. The risk of long COVID is also changing, thanks to vaccinations and less severe Omicron. On the other hand, the decoupling effect is not perfect, especially for high-risk groups. This was clearly reflected in Portugal during the BA5 wave, which is what we're in right now. They have one of the highest vaccination rates in the world, but report a significant excess death among those over 65. Vaccines are not perfect, especially with a highly transmissible variant finding vulnerable pockets. Can we really only focus on severe disease without focusing on transmission? Maybe. If reducing severe disease is our goal, we cannot believe that 450 deaths per day is the best we can do. And I don't think the CDC thinks this. But we need a comprehensive plan to understand who is dying today and, more importantly, why. If they didn't take Paxlovid, why? If they aren't vaccinated, why? If they aren't boosted, why? If they did everything right, how were they infected? Once we have these answers, we can create targeted approaches, like antivirals that people on medication can take to reduce severe disease, even given the current climate. Two, up to date. I absolutely agree with the new language around vaccination. Before, fully vaccinated was used to describe the primary series. However, it's abundantly clear that we need a booster, if not several. Using the language up to date allows for flexibility around our science and understanding, while also making it clear that if you don't have a booster, you are at risk. 3. Individual versus population. The CDC continues to go down the path of individualization. In other words, people need to make their own decisions. This is a very medical perspective. This is a very American perspective. This is not a population health perspective. This will leave people behind. 4, protecting self. If we continue down the path of individualized health, we need to provide evidence-based guidance for people who want to protect themselves. I was disappointed to see this guidance doubled down on the following. Leave isolation after 5 days. We have strong evidence that an Omicron infection lasts on average 8 to 10 days. Peak infections is around day 4 or 5, as demonstrated from an FDA study released earlier this week. While the guidance did state to wear a mask after 5 days and/or avoid high-risk people, this narrative has already been lost. Removing test to exit. I was disappointed to see test to exit removed. Antigen tests are the only tool we have to tell whether or not they are infectious. People need to know this, and they need to leverage this tool. If not enough free antigen tests are available for this policy, we need to fix this. Community levels map to mask. This map tells us when to take collective action so hospitals don't surge. This does not tell us when to wear a mask for individual protection due to high transmission. If we are trying to prevent severe disease, those at most risk should know when they are at risk for infection. 5, larger policy picture. What has been eating at me most all week is around national health policy itself. How much should the CDC meet people where they are versus how much should the CDC set the standard? One epidemiologist drew parallels to the food pyramid. A lot of people don't actually follow the food pyramid, but that doesn't mean the CDC should shy away from striving for better. Unfortunately, unlike the food pyramid, COVID-19 has been incredibly politicized, and polarized. And as much as I hate it, the CDC is not independent of politics. In fact, they are funded through Congress. So, public health policy is not solely based on science. Unfortunately, this creates a dangerous feedback loop. CDC tries to meet people where they are by saying isolate for 5 days, but then an employer uses this guideline to require his employees to be back after 5 days. This forces people who want to stay home but can't. Then, this drives inequities. Those who have high-wage jobs can stay at home or continue to work from home, while people with low-wage jobs don't have this option. How do we get out of this politics health loop? This is an important question, not just with COVID, but with other public health problems like gun violence. I don't have an answer. I don't know if anyone does, which keeps me up at night. What does this guidance mean for me? This changes nothing for me and my family. We will continue to ride the waves based on transmission in the community. There are 3 reasons I do this. 1, I don't want to get sick. I just don't have the time with 2 toddlers running around in a career. 2, I don't want to get long COVID-19. Many of my friends have it, and it is debilitating and absolutely nasty. To me, the risk to adults is still high enough for action. 3, protect the most vulnerable around me, like grandparents. This does not mean that I constantly worry. It also doesn't mean I make perfect decisions, but it does mean that I integrate pandemic tools in my life to reduce risk. For example, my entire family is up to date on vaccines, including my little ones under 5. I still wear a mask in public indoor spaces. If I forget a mask and the store isn't busy, I don't turn around. If it's Costco on a Saturday, though, I turn around and grab my mask. I still wear a mask at the airport. My toddlers do not wear masks at daycare, but we encourage it if traveling on public transit. If they were older, I would encourage it at schools, fully knowing that they would probably take it off with friends. I think that's okay. I'm going to a wedding this weekend and will not wear a mask, but we are antigen testing before. We also continue to take antigen tests before seeing grandparents. My girls absolutely hate it, but it's nothing a lollipop can't fix. As I've written before, we are in a very strange phase in this pandemic, somewhere between endemic and full-blown emergency. If you are confused on what to do, know that we are all confused and just trying to do our best. Give yourselves and others grace through this time. And next up, as a reminder that, guidance is just guidance, and it isn't necessarily what people follow. For some of the gap, the story gets to it. This is from ABC News. Only half of eligible Americans have gotten their first COVID booster. As we approach fall, there's a renewed push to get Americans vaccinated against COVID-19, particularly the elderly and the vulnerable, who continue to bear the brunt of the nation's COVID-19 crisis. Although over 61 million people over the age of 50 are eligible to receive their second COVID-19 booster shot, just a third have actually done so, according to data from the CDC. Similarly, less than half of Americans over the age of 5 who are eligible to receive their first booster have received their supplemental shot. One of the key messages coming out of the moment is, if you are 50 and over and you have not gotten a shot this year, it is absolutely critical that you go and get one now, said White House COVID-19 coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha. Among people ages 50 and older, the unvaccinated had a risk of dying from COVID that was 29 times higher than their fully vaccinated and double boosted peers. Among people ages 50 and older, vaccinated people with one booster dose had a risk of dying from COVID-19 that was 4 times higher than those fully vaccinated and double boosted. Okay, so if you look on the spectrum from a completely unvaccinated person to somebody who's been double boosted, there's a 29-fold difference in risk. But just from getting a first booster to a second booster, there's a 4-fold difference in preventing severe disease. So you get a lot from these boosters. And of course, not only have not people who are eligible for two, often haven't even gotten the first one. So that's very important. On average, about 6,100 virus-positive Americans are now entering a hospital each day. There are currently about 43,000 virus-positive patients hospitalized across the country. The overall number of patients hospitalized has been at a plateau for several weeks. However, numbers remain significantly lower than at the nation's peak, where there were more than 160,000 patients hospitalized with the virus. My two recommendations would be get as many booster shots as you can get and mask up in indoor public spaces.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Well, folks, infectious diseases, unfortunately, are becoming an increasingly important part of health and public health in our world. Now, one of the most interesting developments in that is this polio that's shown up in America and is in New York and seems to have community spread. This from CNN. Silent spread of polio in New York drives CDC to consider additional vaccinations for some people. A team of CDC disease detectives traveled last week from agency headquarters in Atlanta to Rockland County, New York, and they are quite nervous that polio could mushroom out of control very quickly and we could have a crisis on our hands, said a community health leader who has met with the team. What is the opposite of cautiously optimistic, said another community leader, an expert in vaccine education who has met with the CDC team. Both leaders requested anonymity because they are not authorized to speak publicly. The CDC is considering a variety of options to protect people from polio, including offering children in the area an extra shot of the vaccine, just as UK authorities are doing now in London, or recommending extra doses to certain groups of adults. We're looking into all aspects of how to deal with this. At this point, we don't have a definitive answer. The Rockland County polio case is the first identified in the United States in nearly a decade. About 3 in 4 people infected with polio don't have any symptoms, but they're still capable of spreading the virus to others. Among the rest, most have symptoms such as a sore throat or headache that could easily be overlooked or confused with other illnesses. Only a relatively small number, about 1 in 200 infected people, become paralyzed. A few of those who are paralyzed die because they can't breathe. In the late 1940s, polio outbreaks disabled an average of more than 35,000 people a year in the U.S. A vaccination campaign started in 1955, and cases quickly plummeted. Today, a full round of childhood polio vaccinations, four doses between 2 months old and 6 years old, is at least 99% effective. But in recent decades, some small groups have not vaccinated their children against the virus. One of them is within the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community in New York, including in Rockland County. Much of the rest of the religious Jewish community in Rockland County has rallied around the efforts to educate the outliers who refuse to vaccinate, the community health leader said. The vaccine educator in Rockland County said that at the meetings with the CDC team, "We spoke about the need for messaging that resonates, and a press release is not going to cut it." Dr. Mary Leahy, CEO of the largest healthcare provider in Rockland County, has attended meetings with the CDC and said that to get people who are not vaccinating their children against polio to understand the severity of disease, I turned to the grandparents and great-grandparents who actually lived through the days of polio in the 40s and 50s. He said many Americans don't recognize the devastating effect of lifelong paralysis from polio. "I think most of the American public has never seen a case of polio. People have lost that fear, if you will, of the disease." So, you know, that's the kind of the anonymity of public health, is when public health is working and vaccinations are keeping a disease essentially eradicated in our country. If we get pockets of low vaccination, when you get these occasional cases that are transported in from somewhere else in the world, you can start up again community transmission. And of course, you're not going to stop it unless you get enough people vaccinated. So I'm laying this at the feet of the anti-vaxxers, reaping what they sow. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Well, and next up, another newly emerging infectious disease. Good old monkeypox. Now, I've reported a lot on this on the basics, and I have some additional resources in my bonus story section. But this story from Stat News really gets at some of the underlying public health problems with stopping such an epidemic, and is the reason why we have a lot of infectious diseases, like some sexually transmitted diseases, like syphilis, for instance, that are persistent, and if we had adequate resources and political will, we'd probably stamp out, but they continue to roil around in populations and continue to have community spread continuously. So, this is from Stat News. New data from several states show racial disparities in monkeypox infections. New data emerging from some states and localities closely tracking monkeypox outbreaks show extreme racial disparities that are alarming experts. In Georgia, 82% of the people with the disease are black. In North Carolina, it's 70%. But in other places that have released detailed demographic data, there are fewer and sometimes no apparent racial ethnic disparities in monkeypox cases. In both states and nationally, almost all cases involve men who have sex with men. The disparities appear to be further compounded by a lack of vaccine access for people of color. North Carolina's data show black men have received 22% of vaccine doses, a number that corresponds to the black population in the state, but not to the higher number of black men who have actually been infected. Nationally, white men appear to be getting a far larger share of the vaccine, a factor public health experts say is harming efforts to protect vulnerable populations with less access to healthcare resources. To some experts, the disparities are no surprise and closely parallel what occurred when the HIV epidemic struck decades ago, and more recently when COVID-19 swept across the country. We saw it with HIV among marginalized communities in the 1980s, just as we saw the tepid response to COVID-19 that disproportionately infected people of color and those living in poverty, said Joya Mukherjee, the chief medical officer for Partners in Health. It's inexcusable. Mukherjee is among those who have criticized the Biden administration for its slow response to a disease that is having an outsized impact on marginalized populations. Others are upset that the media call declaring monkeypox a national emergency earlier this month made no mention of the disease's disproportionate effect on black Americans. Oni Blackstock, an HIV and primary care physician in New York, said she was also frustrated that no black or Latino queer man was chosen to help lead the administration's monkeypox response. "We have learned less than nothing from COVID," Steffa Safo, a primary care physician at Mount Sinai who specializes in HIV treatment and is the founder of Just Equity for Health, told STAT. "We've gone backwards. The racial disparities appear to be larger in some places than others." In data updated last Thursday by the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, the number of cases in black men is 25%, roughly the same as the proportion of the population that is black. Nearly 30% of the cases that are among Hispanic men, who make up 29% of the population. But Georgia's 82% case rate far outpaces its black population, which is about 30%. The 70% case rate in North Carolina is much higher than the state's black population, which is 21%. The disparities in southern states are no surprise to Melanie Thompson, an HIV physician and researcher who has worked in Georgia for 3 decades and calls disparities, quote, "the theme of our public health story in Georgia and much of the South, whether it be maternal mortality or syphilis or HIV or monkeypox." Georgia has the highest rate of newly diagnosed HIV cases among states, she's noted, with 73% of those cases occurring among black people. Such racial inequalities, she said, are higher in states without Medicaid expansion and where uninsured people are disproportionately black or brown. In Santa Clara County in California, about 40% of cases are among Latino men, while Latinos make up less than 30% of the population there. Across California, 12% of monkeypox cases are in black men, a figure about twice their population in the state. National data from the CDC as of August 5th show that the among cases have been reported to the agency with available demographic data, 26% are among black people, who make up nearly 14% of Americans, and 28% are among Hispanic people, who make up nearly 19% of the population. Given that these data are incomplete because not all states are reporting racial and ethnic data, it's not possible to accurately gauge the extent of the disparities. The total number of monkeypox cases reported in the U.S. is about 11,000. Many experts contacted by STAT said that the national data do not reflect the full extent of racial disparities because not all states are reporting cases promptly or fully reporting accurate racial and ethnic demographics along with the cases. They fear the disparity seen in Georgia and North Carolina could become the norm as more and better quality data are collected. The CDC has noted a recent increase in cases among black men and a decrease among white and Hispanic men, an agency spokesman told STAT. "We're seeing the same problems we have with COVID-19, that we have such a fragmented, underfunded, outdated public health data infrastructure that we can only know what's happening by looking at more of these local jurisdictions," said Caitlin Jadalina, an epidemiologist in Texas and the author of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist, who praised North Carolina for the high quality of data it was providing and for releasing data on vaccine access as well. "I don't think really any of us in public health are surprised about this data, but many are upset. We should not be struggling to get accurate numbers. Some states aren't even reporting data. We don't even know how bad it is." Many physicians and public health experts remain highly concerned that the slow response, education efforts that are not targeted to communities most at risk, and an unequal distribution of the limited supply of monkeypox vaccine will cause great harm to people of color. In New York, Safo said white gay men in Chelsea were able to get many doses of the vaccines that were available. Black and Hispanic men received fewer doses. "When you release the resources, people have privilege are going to access that resource first," she said, suggesting that when vaccines are distributed in certain neighborhoods of color, Harlem for instance, systems should be in place so that only people who can prove they live in that neighborhood receive the vaccines. "We're creating a caste system in who is going to get access to what is needed for monkeypox," Greg Gonsalves, a former AIDS activist and epidemiologist at the Yale School of Public Health, told PBS. What we're seeing is that the health disparities you've seen in COVID, we've seen in HIV, are recapitulating themselves with this new virus, monkeypox. Public health experts say stigma remains a huge obstacle. Many gay men may not seek testing or vaccination for fear of being outed. It's important to note, said Saffo, that people who contract the disease are more vulnerable, partly because of structural inequalities like lack of access to timely health care that would limit the spread of the disease. In some areas, communities of gay men are small and isolated, so the risk of transmission within the group is higher if one person is infected, she said. Collecting better data is crucial to efforts to contain the outbreak and to get better care and resources to those who need it, experts say. The second step is targeted outreach. It's extremely important to collect good data so that we can aim our vaccination and testing in the right direction, said Carlton Thomas, a San Diego gastroenterologist who is gay and active in LGBTQ plus HIV education and is working with the Black AIDS Institute to improve messaging. It gives a sense of who we need to protect more. Thompson, the HIV researcher in Atlanta, said states should be required to provide full demographic data to the CDC in a timely manner so that resources such as testing, vaccines, and the TPOX treatment could be distributed equitably and to the places it is needed. Without data, she said, we are flying blind about where the epidemic is and where services are going.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning. Use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up I have a couple healthcare stories, and this first one really gets at how you can have extremely effective treatment available. In this case, a cure for hepatitis C infection, but find that the healthcare system is really unable to deliver this effectively to the people who need it. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. CDC finds treatment gap in hepatitis C patients. Too few people who are diagnosed with hepatitis C infections receive treatment known to cure the disease, the CDC said in a vital signs report. Less than 1 in 3 people with health insurance got direct-acting antiviral treatment within a year of their hepatitis C diagnosis. Fewer than 1 in 4 people in state-administered Medicare plans got treatment. And people in states that restrict treatment access to Medicare recipients were 23% less likely to be treated. The CDC said its new data shows that adults younger than 40 had the lowest treatment rates, which is also the same group known to have the highest rates of new infections. Of that group, hepatitis C is most commonly spread through injectable drug use. The CDC said it's critical to stop preventable deaths and prevent new infections, especially since the oral treatment is well tolerated. The virus can cause liver disease, cancer, and death. In 2019, the virus was linked to 14,000 deaths in the United States.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
And next up, another story that gets at our fragmented healthcare system. This from Stat News. Access to trauma care is improving across the country, but progress remains uneven. 6 years ago, an expert panel made a strong suggestion to the White House to set up a national system to care for patients with traumatic injuries, which lead to about 30,000 deaths every year. In the civilian sector, where injury is the leading cause of death for Americans under age 46, as many as 1 in 5 deaths from traumatic injuries may be preventable with optimal trauma care, the authors wrote. The national system has yet to emerge, but new research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association has found that access to trauma care improved in the 2010s. The study mapped the distance from each census block to the nearest trauma center, taking into account air and land transport. The researchers found that 91% of people in the U.S. could get to trauma care within 60 minutes by air or land travel, up from 78% in 2013. And I'll just note, if you reverse those numbers, you get actually a better idea. So that means 9% of the people now can't get there within an hour, and 22% in 2013. So that was cut in a little bit more than half. We shouldn't be applauding that, said Brian Daly, chief of the trauma division of the University of Tennessee Medical Center, who was not involved in the new research. We should still say we're lacking 10%. Trauma centers differ from regular hospitals. They have to meet certain benchmarks on care and have specific staff on call around the clock. That is the difference oftentimes between surviving a trauma and surviving it well and not having long-term effects from it and not surviving or having permanent problems from it, said Elizabeth Benjamin, trauma medical director at Grady Memorial Hospital. The study, which looked at trauma centers verified by the American College of Surgeons, found that access differed across regions. Native Americans faced the lowest access to trauma care at 70%, as well as the smallest improvement to access among any group. The share of people living in proximity to a trauma center was also lower in rural states like Wyoming, Montana, South Dakota, and in the South, where it dipped below 50% in 2 states. Most of the South still has periods where it takes over an hour to get to a trauma center, said Daly. And you would think in the 21st century, even with helicopter access and incredible grand transport, that would not be the problem. But it is. Some experts also said that there has been a growth in new trauma centers, particularly for for-profits. For-profit hospitals realize that they can make a profit, said Daly. In many of these places that expanded Medicaid, the reimbursement improved, and so there are additional resources to put into things like trauma. So I think overall the financial picture improved for people to take care of trauma patients. Jeffrey Choi, a surgery resident at Stanford and co-first author of the study, said he and his colleagues became interested in the subject after reading an article last year that suggested a for-profit hospital system was opening new trauma centers to generate profit rather than improve patient care. There's been this feeling that there's been an expansion of trauma centers by certain for-profit healthcare chains, that they're sort of putting trauma centers where they think they can make money, maybe not necessarily where the need is, said David Spain, trauma chief at Stanford and senior author of the study. Spain also said that he worried lower-level trauma centers owned by for-profit operators could draw patients away from level one trauma centers that offer higher quality care. In Florida, which saw access rise nearly 60% between 2013 and 2019, all of the level one centers verified during that time were governed by nonprofit systems, while all of the new credentialed level trauma two centers were run by for-profit companies. There was some data out of Florida that sort of amplified that a lot of the new trauma centers were placed, maybe not in areas of high need, but in areas where it was good business venture, Spain said. You may decrease the amount of patients that actually come to the level one trauma center. They just all go to these level twos out in the suburbs. This work was done primarily by states and by organizations outside the federal government, said Daly, who is chair of the Tennessee Committee on Trauma. For many years, our trauma organizations have fought for a unified national system with help through the government. And there's no fancy ribbon for trauma. There's no National Trauma Month or anything like that. So here we have this disjointed system. Even when you have improvements, they're very uneven. And some of the improvements might actually undercut care for many people going to a lower level of care than might be available if we had a consistent system that was organized across the entire country. Sounds like a good call as any for universal health care for all.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, now I'm going to change pace a little bit and go to a couple stories that tie together climate change and the rise of infectious diseases in our world. This from fastcompany.com. Climate change is going to make infectious disease far, far worse. Climate change can exacerbate a full 58% of the infectious diseases that humans come in contact with worldwide, with common waterborne viruses to deadly diseases like plague, our new research shows. Our team of environment and health scientists reviews decades of scientific papers of all known pathogenic disease pathogens to create a map of the human risks aggravated by climate-related hazards. The numbers were jarring. Of 375 human diseases, we found that 218 of them, well over half, can be affected by climate change. Flooding, for example, can spread hepatitis. Rising temperatures can expand the life of mosquitoes carrying malaria. Droughts can bring rodents infected with hantavirus into communities as they search for food. With climate change influencing more than 1,000 transmission pathways like those, and climate hazards increasing globally, we concluded that expecting societies to successfully adapt to all of them isn't a realistic option. The world would need to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that are driving climate change to reduce these risks. To be able to prevent global health crises, humanity needs a comprehensive understanding of the pathways and the magnitude with which climate change might affect pathogenic diseases. We focus on 10 climate-related hazards linked to rising greenhouse gas emissions: atmospheric warming, heat waves, drought, wildfires, heavy precipitation, flooding, storms, sea level rise, ocean warming, and land cover change. Then we look for studies discussing specific and quantifiable observations of human disease occurrences linked to those hazards. In total, we reviewed over 77,000 scientific papers. Of those, 830 papers had a climate hazard affecting a specific disease in an explicit place and or time, allowing us to create a database of climatic hazards, transmission pathways, pathogens, and diseases. An interactive map of every pathway between hazard and pathogen is available online. The largest number of diseases aggravated by climate change involve vector-borne transmission, such as those spread by mosquitoes, bats, or rodents. Looking at the type of climate hazard, the majority were associated with atmospheric warming, that's 160 diseases, heavy precipitation, 122 diseases, and flooding, 121 diseases. How climate influences pathogen risk? We found four key ways climatic hazards interact with pathogens in humans. 1. Climate-related hazards bring pathogens closer to people. In some cases, climate-related hazards are shifting the range of animals and organisms that can act as vectors for dangerous pathogenic diseases. For example, warming or changes in precipitation patterns can alter the distribution of mosquitoes, which are vectors of numerous human pathogenic diseases. In recent decades, geographic changes in outbreaks of mosquito-borne diseases such as malaria and dengue fever have been linked to these climatic hazards. 2. Climate-related hazards bring people closer to pathogens. Climate disasters can also alter human behavior patterns in ways that increase their chances of being exposed to pathogens. For example, during heat waves, people often spend more time in water, which lead to an increase in waterborne disease outbreaks. Notably, Vibrio-associated infections increased substantially in Sweden and Finland following a heat wave in northern Scandinavia in 2014. 3. Climate-related hazards enhance pathogens. In some cases, climate-related hazards have led to either environmental conditions that increase opportunities for pathogens to interact with vectors or increase the ability of pathogens to cause severe disease in humans. For example, standing water left by heavy precipitation and flooding can provide breeding grounds for mosquitoes, leading to increased transmission of diseases such as yellow fever, dengue, malaria, West Nile fever, and leishmaniasis. Studies have shown that rising temperatures may also help viruses become more resistant to heat, resulting in increased disease severity as pathogens become better able to adapt to fever in the human body. For instance, studies have suggested that rising global temperatures are leading an increased heat tolerance of fungal pathogens. The sudden appearance on multiple continents of treatment-resistant human infections of Candida auris, a fungus that was previously non-pathogenic to humans, has been associated with increasing global temperatures. Similarly, fungi in urban environments have been shown to be more heat-tolerant than those in rural areas, which tend to be cooler. 4. Climate-related hazards weaken the body's ability to cope with pathogens. Climate-related hazards can affect the human body's ability to cope with pathogens in two ways. They can force people into hazardous conditions, such as when disaster damage leads to people living in crowded conditions that might lack good sanitation or increase their exposure to pathogens. Hazards can also reduce the body's capacity to fight off pathogens through malnutrition, for example. Living through climatic hazards may also induce increased cortisol production from stress, leading to a reduction in the human body's response to it. What to do about it? Climate change presents a significant threat to human lives, health, and socioeconomic well-being. Our map shows just how extensive that threat can be. In our view, to dial back the risk, humanity will have to put the brakes on the human-caused greenhouse gas emissions fueling global warming. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is We Act Radio, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up we have a follow-up as a specific example of that larger story about climate-affecting infections. This from the Washington Post. New Langia virus that may have spilled over from animals infects dozens. An international team of scientists identified a new virus that was likely to have been transmitted to humans after it first infected animals, and another potential zoonotic spillover less than 3 years into the coronavirus pandemic. A peer-reviewed study published in the New England Journal of Medicine detailed the discovery of the Langia virus after it was observed in 35 patient samples collected in two eastern Chinese provinces. The researchers, based in China, Singapore, and Australia, did not find evidence that the virus transmitted between people, citing in part the small sample size available, but they hypothesized that shrews, small mammals that subsist on insects, could have hosted the virus before it infected humans. The first Langia virus sample was detected in late 2018 from a farmer in Shandong province who sought treatment for a fever. Over a roughly two-year period, 34 other people were found to have been infected in Shandong and neighboring Henan, with the vast majority being farmers. Genetic sequencing of the virus subsequently showed that the pathogen is part of the henopeparavirus family, which has five other known viruses. Two are considered highly virulent and are associated with high case fatality ratios, according to the CDC, but none of the Langia patients died, the study stated. Among the 35 patients, 26 were found to be infected only with the Langia virus. All of the 26 had a fever, with around half showing fatigue, decreased white blood cell count, and cough. More severe symptoms include impaired kidney and liver functions. Researchers also tested 25 small wild animal species for the Langia virus. Its genetic material was predominantly detected in shrews, leading the team to suggest the small mammals are a natural reservoir for the virus. Disease surveillance did not indicate sources of common exposure common among those infected, nor did they come in close contact with one another, suggesting that human infection may have occurred in a sporadic fashion, the researchers wrote. Francis Ballou, a computational systems biology professor at University College London, who was not involved in the study, said the Langia virus does not appear to look like a repeat of COVID-19. He noted on Twitter that the new virus is far less lethal than other henna paraviruses and probably doesn't transmit easily from humans to humans. But this discovery serves as yet another reminder of the looming threat caused by the many pathogens circulating in populations of wild and domestic animals that have the potential to affect human beings. Viruses that spill over from animals to humans are not uncommon. Some 70% of emerging infectious diseases in humans are of zoonotic origin, scientists say, and nearly 1.7 million undiscovered viruses may exist in mammals and birds. The Hendra and Nipah viruses, two henopareviruses with high mortality rates, can be contracted through close contact with sick horses, pigs, and bats. Scientists who study zoonotic diseases had warned even before the coronavirus pandemic that practices such as unregulated wildlife trade, deforestation, and urbanization had brought people closer to animals, thereby increasing the odds of viral spillovers. Okay, well, I'd like to close the regular reporting in this episode with a little bit of better news, a new tool that we have in public health. This from the Health and Human Services Department of the United States, HHS.gov, federal health agencies unveil national tool to measure health impacts of environmental burdens. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, in partnership with the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Environmental Justice, announced the release of the Environmental Justice Index. The Environmental Justice Index builds off existing environmental justice indexes to provide a single environmental justice score for local communities across the United States so that public health officials can identify and map areas most at risk for the health impacts of environmental burden. It is the first national geographic-driven tool designed to measure the cumulative impacts of environmental burden through the lens of human health and health equity. Cumulative impacts are the total harm to human health that occur from the combination of environmental burden, such as pollution and poor environmental conditions, pre-existing health conditions, and social factors. An example of how pre-existing health conditions can be worsened by environmental burden would be two people with asthma. One person lives in a community with elevated air pollution, and the other does not. While both people have asthma, the person living in a community with elevated air pollution may be more likely to be hospitalized based on having both factors. To many communities across our nation, particularly low-income communities and communities of color, continue to bear the brunt of pollution. Meeting the needs of these communities requires our focused attention, and we will use the Environmental Justice Index to do just that, said Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra. Addressing environmental injustice is critical to advancing health equity, said CDC Director Rochelle Walensky. While everyone is at some risk from the health impacts of environmental hazards, the communities that are most affected are often those that are already experiencing health inequities. CDC is taking action to address the adverse health effects associated with environmental injustice by identifying those most at risk with tools like the Environmental Justice Index. Everyone deserves to live, learn, and work in a healthy community, and this new tool builds on existing environmental screening tools, said Patrick Bryce, the director of the National Center for Environmental Health. The Environmental Justice Index strengthens the scientific evidence on the cumulative health impacts of environmental burden on communities across the country. The Environmental Justice Index was created to help public health officials and communities identify and map communities most at risk for facing the health impacts of environmental hazards. Social factors such as poverty, race, and ethnicity, along with pre-existing health conditions, may increase these impacts. Communities are at the heart and the center of the Health and Human Services environmental justice work. This tool will serve as a resource for communities and public health officials to identify and prioritize overburdened communities so we can work together to provide solutions to the problems they may be facing, said the HHS Assistant Secretary for Health, Rachel Levine, who oversees the Office of Environmental Justice at the department. The Environmental Justice Index can help public health officials, policymakers, and communities identify and respond to the unique environmental and social factors that affect a community's health and well-being. Specifically, the Environmental Justice Index databases and maps can be used to identify areas that may require special attention or additional resources to improve health and health equity, educate and inform the public about their community, analyze the unique local factors driving cumulative impacts on health to inform policy and decision making, and establish meaningful goals and measure progress towards environmental justice and health equity. Environmental injustice can have profound effects, negative effects on human health and well-being. Addressing these negative effects is a key part of promoting health equity. In addition to delivering a single environmental justice score for each community, the Environmental Justice Index also scores communities on each of the three modules of the tool: social vulnerability, environmental birth, and health vulnerability, and allows more detailed analysis within these modules. So this is actually broken down to like the census tract area, so it's really cool. So if you're a data freak and are interested in any of this social vulnerability, environmental burden, or health vulnerability, or the sum total of those for an overall score, you can get more information about the Environmental Justice Index at eji.cdc.gov. That's eji.cdc.gov. Okay, we're up to the segment Bonus Articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. We have 10 bonus articles this week. First up, a primer on monkeypox, what scientists know and don't know about how monkeypox spreads. Another monkeypox story, too. Fear of losing battle to control monkeypox in California, U.S. as cases surge. So this is an L.A. Times story that focuses on California, but is a good example of what the challenges we face with monkeypox. 3, with support on monkeypox hard to come by, queer communities turn to one another. So this is something that often happens, is that marginalized communities who are disproportionately affected often have to do activism themselves and support within their own communities to get what they need. 4, decriminalizing HIV, scientifically proven and morally correct. 134 countries criminalize or prosecute people based on general criminal laws of HIV transmission, non-disclosure, or exposure. And I place that one after the monkeypox because we're seeing a lot of parallels between the early responses to HIV and monkeypox today. Story 5. America has a maternity mortality crisis. Biden has a plan, at least an attempt to jumpstart the whole-of-government approach. 6. Why tween girls especially are struggling so much. 7. How to ease the transition to college when mental health is a concern. So if you have a tween girl, that story 6 is a good one. And if you know somebody or yourself are going to college and have mental health concerns, that's a good good story to get some resources and perspective on. 8. An interesting cultural background story on abortion. Why Hollywood keeps getting abortion wrong. The portrayal does not reflect reality very much. Story 9. How to talk about disability sensitivity and avoid ableist tropes. 10. Social media posts criticize the 988 suicide hotline for calling police. Here's what you need to know. So the new unified 3-number 988 suicide hotline, there has been some concerns that you could get the police called on you, and that varies by community and by the type of caller, but if you're concerned about that and want to help sort that out, this is a really good story for delving into that. And last but not least, 11, how safe are nuclear power plants? A new history reveals that federal regulators consistently assured Americans that the risk of massive accident was, quote, vanishingly small, even when they knew they had insufficient evidence to prove it. And unfortunately, here in our local region, the Davis-Bessie plant is probably the most likely to blow up or melt down. And this article, as an example, cited that from one source that there's a 70% chance in the next decade to have a meltdown worldwide with about 500 nuclear plants. We have 92 operating in this country. You can read these and all the stories in this episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-